Hello, Emerson Green. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Actually, it's in the middle of the midnight here because we have like 12 hours difference from Indonesia and the United States. So, let's talk about philosophy first, but can you introduce yourself?
My name's Emerson Green. I have a YouTube channel called Emerson Green, and I started a podcast several years ago called Counter Apologetics, and I just talked about atheism and philosophy of religion, but the aim of that was like fairly narrow, so I started another podcast called Walden Pod that's a little bit more free for all, but I often talk about like philosophy of mind stuff. But yeah, I mean, most of that stuff finds its way on YouTube. Actually, only half of it does, but at least recently, the things that I've been making do find their way on YouTube. But yeah, that's what I do.
So, do you describe yourself as a philosopher?
Not really, because I mean, I sort of feel like if people attribute that to me, then that would be a huge honor. But I usually don't attribute it to myself. It's sort of like calling yourself a dissident or something. It's like, it's better if other people call you that, but you don't really want to call yourself it. Because, I mean, also, I'm not like an academic philosopher. I mean, if it's your job, then that's one thing. But, I'm just a podcaster who has an interest in philosophy and like, I like to think about things and write about them and, I share it with other people. But I don't really go around calling myself a philosopher, even though, I do philosophy, but it's like, I play guitar, but I guess I do call myself a guitarist, but I guess there's like a fine line, like just doing something doesn't mean that you like have, you've earned the label of, I'm a guitarist or a drummer or a philosopher,
How do you describe your philosophy?
I guess you mean like systematically or something, or like method, or what do you mean?
If people ask me that question, I will usually say that I'm a naturalist. I'm leaning towards agnostic atheist, something like that.
Okay. I was an atheist for the better part of a decade, and like my views haven't like radically changed, but I think I'm an agnostic now. It was kind of a gradual change, but I guess I'm agnostic, and I'm a non-physicalist. Over the past like year or two, I've started leaning more towards intuition-based philosophy, like more consciously, and influenced by like Michael Humer, and I mean, what else? I mean, just some other things I believe. I guess I believe in free will, but I have no idea whether determinism is true or not. But either way, I think free will is fine. So I guess I don't believe in God, but I'm, I feel like I'm kind of in the middle. Like there are some good arguments for theism, and there are some good arguments against theism. I think consciousness is non-physical. I think free will is real. I'm not sure what else is relevant, but those are the things I talk about most often, I guess.
What makes you think that free will is real? I mean, I don't really believe in free will, but I never really put too much thought into it. But do you have any idea about why do you think that is?
I mean, at first I was influenced by like Sam Harris, when I was first getting into like philosophical subjects, he was kind of, I mean, for a lot of people, it's like Sam Harris or Jordan Peterson, or, seems like a pretty popular one recently. But hopefully, even if they get you interested in some topics, hopefully you go deeper and start dealing with people who, produce much, much higher quality work. Sam Harris got me into the topic, and I kind of agreed with him, like, okay, free will isn't real. Like if you kind of reflect on your own internal stream of consciousness, thoughts just appear, you know, impulses and so on just appear. But I don't know, like the more that I like try, I mean, I thought that for like several years, and just I don't know, keeping that like consistently in your head, like really that there's no free will. I mean, it's just such a normal part of our language, and it always felt like I was kind of going into like philosophy land when I was saying free will wasn't real. Like it just seemed so impractical, and like it's like it almost felt like I didn't really mean it on some level. Like, oh yeah, if you I mean, I guess the charitable way of seeing that is like, oh well, my most considered opinion is that free will isn't real, but occasionally I use language and invoke concepts, you know, legally and morally that seem to involve free will. But it didn't feel like that was the case. Like it just felt like I was invoking concepts and language all the time that, you know, made use of free will. And eventually I just started thinking, well, you know, maybe it's such a useful concept because there's something to it. Like maybe it's so hard to get rid of in my language because it's real. So I started like reflecting on the arguments against free will, which Sam Harris's is pretty weird. Yeah. But, you know, the more standard arguments against free will, and just thought they were kind of lacking, and, you know, ultimately became convinced that like, okay, free will is compatible with determinism, unless you understand determinism in kind of like a naive way. But as long as I could have done otherwise in some sense, which is true, even if determinism is true, in some like kind of thin sense, I could have done otherwise, like in some epistemic sense. Just like in the same way that like flipping a coin or rolling dice, you know, could have come up otherwise. That's the whole point. So it's like, I think I do have some sense of like, I could have done otherwise, and I don't think it's threatened by determinism, which I have no idea whether determinism is true or not, but like, I don't think it would threaten that like thinner sense of could have done otherwise, which a lot of philosophers think is important for free will. And also I can obviously be the source of my actions. If determinism is true, like whether it's true or not, like something can really come from me. Like I can, there's a difference between doing something voluntarily, intentionally, you know, like in accordance with my will and my nature, and those criteria not being satisfied when I'm doing something like involuntarily, you know, against my will. So, you know, I think that I can be the source of my actions in like a, you know, morally relevant sense. And I think that I could have done otherwise, you know. So I mean, if that's what free will is, then like, yeah, I have free will because I can be the source of my actions, you know, and I could have done otherwise. And the philosophers think that's what free will is. So I have free will.
What if our actions driven unconsciously from our memories that practically gained from external world, but because we aren't aware about the influence of our memory has or our genetic has, we say that it's come from ourselves. I think genetic is inherited, so whenever our actions determined by our genetic, that means it's in some sense it's influenced outside of our control. What do you think about that, if that's the case?
Yeah, no, it definitely is the case. Like genetics has a huge role to play in like what you do. There's this section of a book called The Gene by Siddhartha Mukherjee that I really liked. It's talking about the Minnesota study of twins reared apart, and there are all these, just these insane similarities between these identical twins that were separated at birth and, you know, sort of adopted by different families. And in many cases, they didn't know the other one existed. And then, these researchers tracked them down and then just started, you know, asking them questions and, you know, giving them tests and stuff. And there are all these really interesting correlations, you know, that seem to suggest that, okay, well, you know, there's some genetic basis for these things that correlate extremely well. You know, like, and not just things like IQ or religiosity, but, you know, like really weird specific things. Like there were two twins that would have the same nightmare of like metallic objects being shoved down their throat. Or there was one guy, there were these two identical twins separated who married a woman named Linda. Both of them married a woman named Linda. Both of them had a dog that they named Toy. Both of them liked stock car racing. And they both like got headaches like frequently at the same point in their life. I mean, those are not things we normally attribute to genetics, but apparently it plays some role, you know, at least towards predisposing them towards, you know, really odd specific things. At least, you know, that seems suggested by that. So, yeah, of course, like genetics actually makes some people really uncomfortable how much genetics has to do with the way that your life turns out. But, you know, it's true. But I just don't think it's a threat to free will because that's who you are. Like you can't say, oh, that's not me. That's my genes. It's like, no, that's part of your nature. Like that's part of your constitution. That's part of who you are. To say, oh, I'm not the source. My genes are the source. It's like, yeah, you know, I mean, you can, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I can sort of make sense of it. If you're trying to say like, if you're trying to blame your genes for something, you might be trying to say like, look, I don't want to be this way. I would like to change, but you know, I have this horrible predisposition. Okay, you know, well, good for you. I'm glad that you know you want to be different, but like, you can't really make a huge, huge division between you and your genes. You know, like those are part of your constitution. So, you know, just because you're not like the ultimate, you know, like unmoved mover, kind of first cause of your actions, I don't think that threatens free will in the way that some people seem to. So, you know, like one analogy I've given before is I think that my faucet is a source of water. I'm pretty sure I'm correct about that my faucet is a source of water, but it's not really like a strike against that proposition. If you say, oh, but the water comes from somewhere else, you know, like it's not the ultimate source of water. Water is not just generated ex nihilo by your faucet. It's like, yeah, but who cares? Like it's still the source of that water, you know, even though it's not the ultimate source of that water. So I don't know, just going a little bit farther back in the causal chain, to me, it just doesn't immediately threaten, you know, my claim to sourcehood.
Okay. Yeah. I actually, not prepared to talk about free will because our agreement was to talk about something like counter apologetics and something adjacent to that. But yeah, I guess it's a very good thing to consider, at least for myself, because I never really thought about free will like that. So yeah, let's talk about your deconversion first. Can you tell me the story behind your deconversion?
Yeah, so I mean, I was raised in a loving home by two wonderful parents who, you know, I still have a great relationship with and who I really admire for a lot of reasons. But I came to, you know, disagree with them about their religious worldview and the religious worldview of my wider community. So, you know, I guess we were Protestant started getting a little bit more charismatic, you know, near the end, like speaking in tongues and faith healing and that sort of thing. But that was like only the last couple of years. It was much more like conservative prior to that. But they, I believed in young earth creationism, didn't believe in evolution, took the Bible literally, believed in like eternal conscious torment for non-Christians. And, you know, just the story just kind of fell apart for me. Like I started questioning the efficacy of prayer and like the value of just having faith in things. So there were some concerns about like religious epistemology, you know, to put it broadly, like, you know, I didn't really think that having faith was admirable or, you know, something that I should be doing. I kind of wanted evidence and I wanted things to make sense. And the thing is about that worldview is that it's definitely false. The like kind of young earth creationist literalist picture of the world, there's like no chance whatsoever that that's true. Like, I think that Christianity might be true. I think God might exist. You know, like I think a totally reasonable person can believe that God exists, that Christianity is true. But like it's just not possible. Like it does not withstand scrutiny, like the kind of worldview that I was coming from. And I saw that, but the thing is, I believed that like this is the only form of Christianity. Like this is it. Every other kind of Christianity is fake. Like, you know, this kind of like hyper literalist, inerrantist, creationist worldview. I'm like, look, this is Christianity. Everything else is like deviating from the original form. You know, everything else is like diluting the truth. So like, you know, I don't know, just the way I saw it, it's like either like the purest form of this is true. And like, why would I go for something that's like, you know, this kind of like watered down version of it? Makes no sense. But like, that's just how like a fundamentalist thinks. So, you know, I went very quickly, you know, too quickly from Christian to atheist. And, you know, and it had a lot to do with internal contradictions in like the narrative of Christianity. You know, so I, you know, the atonement had something to do with it. But like, so, I mean, and then eternal conscious torment, you know, to me, which was the only view of hell, like that you could possibly have as a real Christian. You know, that was the source of quite a lot of my issues, like with Christianity and with theism. And honestly, if I had just been exposed to other parts of the tradition and taught that they were, you know, valid, that they were not like lies being spread by Satan, then, you know, who knows what would have happened. But like, it's just, I thought, look, this is the only form of Christianity, and this definitely isn't true. And the thing is, like, my opinion about that hasn't changed at all. It definitely isn't true. You know, like, it's like, you know, I want to look at myself from 10 years ago and just be like, okay, good job. You figured out that like the least plausible thing ever isn't true, but like you may be going a little too fast here, you know, like as you're like slingshotting to atheism. And, you know, it's sort of been like gradually traveling back. Like, and now I'm sort of like in like a center position. And I can't say that I see myself becoming a Christian again, because you know, like I've since thought about things more deeply and read people who are much, much smarter than me. And there are just parts of Christianity that I think are just, I just think it's totally implausible. And like, you know, I don't really, like I said, at this point, I can't really see it happening. But, you know, I was like a, you know, an atheist who's like basically certain of atheism. And I was also like a nihilist and stuff, because again, I was told that that's just what an atheist is. It's like, or you know, if you're not a Christian and you have to be this specific type of Christian, then you're an atheist, and atheists are nihilists and all that. So it's like my deconversion was totally conditioned by you know, or like colored and shaped by my like fundamentalist worldview. And you know, sort of I've never used the word deconstructing before, but sort of like deconstructing that worldview kind of led me to eventually become agnostic. But, you know, it's just Christians are not doing themselves any favors when they act like there's only one possible version of Christianity. And like, there's this list of, you know, necessary and sufficient conditions for being a Christian that you, you know, like you must satisfy these criteria or else you are not a Christian. You're not doing yourself any favors with that, because some people are going to disagree with those, and then they're going to think, well, I guess I'm not a Christian then, you know? Plus just like, what are the odds that you're not wrong about something? You know, like, so you're giving me this list of like things that you have to believe as a Christian. Like, you know, you're probably wrong about at least one of those things on that list. So like, this is just like a recipe for making deconverts, you know, like these fundamentalists, like I said, they are like, they have a perfect strategy for making people leave the religion. They say like, here's this list of things that I've decided are the true form of Christianity. And if you deviate from even one of these, you might as well be an atheist, you know? And it's like, okay, well, guess what? A lot of people are going to disagree with at least one of those. And they might share your fundamentalist worldview that like, yeah, you're either a Christian or you're an atheist. What's the point of doing it halfway and being one of these fake liberal Christians, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, like my atheism became a lot more reasonable as time went on. But yeah, it started off in kind of an unreasonable place. Like it makes no sense to say, well, the Christian story is just totally incoherent because, you know, there's this giant bomb, you know, like eternal conscious torment right in the middle of it. you know, I just ultimately don't think it's that hard to see that certain forms of Christianity are false. But that doesn't mean God doesn't exist. Like, just because, you know, Ken Ham is wrong or whatever, or Frank Turek is wrong, that does not mean that Christianity is false. Christianity is a very diverse tradition, and theism is an even more diverse tradition. So I eventually ended up where I am now, which is being an agnostic.
So before you became an agnostic, you were an atheist, right?
Yep, for about a decade.
Wow, that's quite a long time. What made you an agnostic? What made you driven away from an atheist? What are the reasons?
Well, I guess first and foremost is just recognizing that the extremely specific version of Christianity that I had subscribed to, it's not like, you know, my way or the highway with theism. So again, it was just kind of the recognition that, like, okay, you know, Frank Turek is wrong, Ken Ham is wrong, that does not equal God does not exist. Very basic realization, but still, for someone who has like a fundamentalist mindset, it takes a while. It didn't take me 10 years to figure that out, but it took me, like, you know, probably like a solid year to really get away from that mindset. But the thing that sort of pushed me towards agnosticism over time was arguments for theism that I thought were pretty good. And I interpret those arguments as being for like a value selection hypothesis. So like my atheism was, you know, primarily informed by, or was primarily supported by arguing for the hypothesis of indifference. So I would argue that, you know, evil, the evil that we see in the world, the distribution of evil, the kind of evil, the degree of evil, like these, like that was, like pretty much overwhelming evidence for the hypothesis of indifference, which is just roughly the idea that the universe is indifferent, you know, like there's not some kind of, you know, the most common rejection of that is theism, where there's this being that's foundational to reality that is like maximally powerful and perfectly good and cares about you personally and like knows the number of hairs on your head. So, I mean, like that's about as non-indifferent as the universe can possibly get. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have, you know, maybe like here's one version of the hypothesis of indifference. So fundamental to reality is just physical stuff, which can be exhaustively characterized by, you know, some kind of hypothetical theory of everything. So like you have like some physical theory, which can be exhaustively characterized in like the mathematical gnomic language of physics. And that's all that reality ultimately is. You know, it's just physical stuff, just kind of changing over time according to these laws of nature. Okay, well, you know, that's a totally indifferent universe, you know, because like these, you know, laws of physics, like they don't care about good or evil or value or disvalue. So the thing is, there's some pretty good evidence for the hypothesis of indifference. Like I said, it's mainly the argument from evil. So I would argue for the hypothesis of indifference, and then theism is incompatible with the hypothesis of indifference. So like to the extent that you're sure the hypothesis of indifference is true, that's the extent you can be sure, the extent to which you can be sure that theism is false. So I thought the hypothesis of indifference is probably true, which means theism is probably false. The thing is, like, I came to think the hypothesis of indifference is actually not true because there's overwhelming evidence, I think, for, you know, like value and goodness playing a role in why things are the way they are on like a fundamental level. Like the laws of nature, I think, do not strike me as indifferent. In particular, psychophysical laws don't strike me as just, you know, the product of total indifference. So, psychophysical laws, and then to a lesser extent, physical laws in general, you know, like I think there's something to some versions of the fine-tuning argument. So basically what pushed me away from atheism is evidence for a value selection hypothesis. Because I'm still not a theist, so I don't think the universe is totally and utterly indifferent. But I don't think that the theistic forms of the value selection hypothesis are very plausible, all things considered. But still, I think the value selection hypothesis is true. Yeah.
So one of the arguments that kind of make me not an atheist is the cosmological argument, and it's the kalam. I actually quite ashamed to say that I really really convinced by that argument, but I don't believe that the gods that all humans have ever invented is true. I'm pretty sure 99.99%. But I'm 50-50 about the existence of the god that might be creating this world in one way or another. And one of the arguments that works for me is the kalam cosmological argument. Now, I think your arguments, your reasons of leaving theism is the morality, the moral of God. Am I true?
I mean, the problem of evil is the main reason I was an atheist.
How about, have you ever considered what if God is not good? I mean, what if God is just like you said, indifferent in some way, and then when you consider that premise, and then you consider the other argument about cosmological argument, and then you see that argument is actually quite makes sense, will you reconsider being a theist again?
Well, so I mean, what kind of God are we talking about? Like a God that is still all powerful and all knowing, but just not all good?
I don't know. I'm an agnostic myself. I've never really thought much about that, but I just think it's quite fun to consider every kind of possibility about God being exist.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there are many models of God, and the thing is, like, I don't love the ones that are like sort of more deistic, like what I was getting at a moment ago was like, okay, well, let's just say God is evil or something, or just indifferent. It's like, okay, well, if he's still all powerful and all knowing, and you're just changing the like the morality part, then I actually am not so sure that that is coherent. So like Stephen Law has this evil God challenge where he says, oh, well, you know, theodicies are, you know, about as compelling as anti-theodicies, which are explanations of, you know, why do good things happen to good people or whatever. So like, imagine there's like, yeah, an evil God, and then it's like, oh, well, you know, like think about the problem of the good, and then like, you yeah, know, what responses would you have for, like, you know, so it's like, I used to think that was, you know, like effective in certain contexts, you know, like he's making a particular point. But it's just like, I'm kind of wondering if an evil God is like a totally intelligible idea, because I think that there are moral facts. So if God is all knowing, then, you know, he would know all the moral facts. And I think that moral facts can be like motivating, like they give you reasons for acting in a certain way and reasons for not acting in other ways. So it's a little bit hard for me to think about a God who's like perfectly knowledgeable, but still somehow evil or like indifferent to suffering. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't really think that makes sense on some level. Yeah, like, I think that there may be a move that, like, I mean, given certain meta-ethical views, I think that an all-knowing being who is, like, evil or indifferent might just not make any sense. Now, it's not just moral realism, the meta-ethical view that you'd have to adopt. It would also have to be some other view about, like a non-Humean view about some meta-ethical thing. There's I'm trying to remember this paper that I read. I think his name is Christopher Weaver. Anyway, I remember like kind of having this thought and seeing if I could I was like trying to find something about it, like if anyone else had had this kind of thought, and there was a paper about this where it like identifies kind of the two meta-ethical assumptions that you need to say that the evil god is incoherent. And it turns out I already accepted both of them. But yeah, I didn't read the paper in like detail or anything, so that's why my recounting of the argument sucks so much. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of my suspicion, is just like, you know, moral knowledge. I mean, you can't have a being that's all-knowing and evil or indifferent or something. I don't think those models of God are internally coherent, which, you know, granted, you need some meta-ethical assumptions to make that the case, but I accept those meta-ethical assumptions.
How does it feel to be a not believer?
Feels fine. I mean, like, I was not like a, you know, horribly depressed, and you know, like, I don't know, being an atheist and being an agnostic, like, it's not like you just lead this hopeless existence of you know, despair. I mean most of my problems are similar to everyone else's problems. Like, I don't really buy that everyone needs religion or needs God, like, in order to lead like a hopeful existence. But then again, I don't think about death that often. And maybe if I thought about death more, then I'd be more upset about being an atheist or agnostic. Because, I mean, typically atheists and agnostics do not believe in an afterlife. But there's not really any good reason for that. Like, I mean, a lot of atheists, like, there are a lot of correct stereotypes about atheists and what they believe. But I think that atheists kind of put walls around themselves. Like, they put themselves in a box, like, for no good reason, where they're like, oh, I'm an atheist, you know? So, like, they feel kind of like compelled to defend materialism and like free will skepticism and, you know, the idea there's no afterlife and nihilism and stuff. And it's like, yeah, you don't have to do that. Like, you know, you can, like, just because, like, there are Christians who tell you that, like, that's what atheists think, you actually don't have to think that. Like, you can be an atheist who believes in an afterlife. The only reason that sounds weird to people is for contingent historical sociological reasons, you know? Like, there is no like essential connection between atheism and you know, materialism or nihilism or anything like that. So, you know, I was kind of agnostic about the afterlife, and I'm sort of, I don't know, I'm not just agnostic anymore. I'm kind of like leaning in favor of there being an afterlife, even though I don't believe in God. And it's just, again, if that sounds weird to people, then you're just, I mean, it's like, it's weird in the same way as, like, I don't know, putting a shoe on your head or something. It's just kind of like, dude, it's not like, it's like contradictory. There's no tension between atheism and like believing in a soul or believing in an afterlife or believing that consciousness continues after death. Like, atheism is just, you know, God doesn't exist. That's it. Like, you don't have to accept this laundry list of things that, you know, Frank Turek says you have to accept. But anyway, I think the only real difficulty I can think of, you know, like being an atheist, is stuff that is not really essential to atheism. You know, like I can imagine how it would be hard to live without a belief in an afterlife in some ways. You know, I would like to live forever. That would be cool. So, you know, I mean, like, the first thing that came to mind, you say, oh, what's it like being an atheist? It's like, you know, it's just the only difficulty that really came to mind was the afterlife thing. But that's not an essential part of atheism, you know? Like, that's a thing that atheists impose on themselves. But, like, you can believe in an afterlife. Maybe you just think there's no evidence for it. But if history is any guide, then I think a lot of atheists who believe that are not really researching it as deeply as they could be.
So you believe in afterlife?
Now, I mean, I'm kind of agnostic, but I maybe lean slightly in favor of consciousness in some form
I
continuing
see.
after our bodily deaths.
So what do you imagine the afterlife would look like?
I don't have any, the only thing that I'm, like I said, I slightly lean in favor, but ultimately I'm like, could go either way. The only thing that applies to is just consciousness in some form continuing after bodily death. I have literally no other details. That's just everything else I am not agnostic about. I don't have any particular reason for thinking it's true, but again, very narrow claim here, just consciousness in some form continuing after bodily death. I have no opinion about what that would look like.
Yeah, but I guess it's kind of cool if we can, imagining some kind of like the library of consciousness. But I'm not so sure when every consciousness there is would be labeled by our name, because I don't think if our conscious should there is a consciousness without body, I don't think they would be labeled by our name, because I think the one who give us name is without any influence of our prior consciousness. Yeah, my name was given by my father, so I don't think when my father gave me my name, he gave the conscious the name. But yeah, to get back to the point, I think it would be cool if there is a library of consciousness. This is just a nonsense talking. I just like to entertain the idea of the possibility of the afterlife. I think it's kind of cool because I never heard everyone, literally everyone, talk considering its possibility, especially coming from the West. Of course, myself, I always hear about the afterlife from my old religion, and since I'm in Indonesia, it's basically one of the stories that told the most about life after death, mostly going to hell. So yeah, I just try to conjure up an idea and an image about afterlife. So yeah, I think that would be cool. But yeah, okay, N not going to entertain it again. By the way, you have a channel Counter Apologetics, right? Why Countering Apologetic?
Well, I started it because I thought I had something, to offer. Like I was listening to atheist channels and podcasts, and like the stuff that I wanted to talk about the most was not really being covered. And when it was being covered, it wasn't covered in the way that I thought was best. So, I mean, again, it started off fairly narrow. I just wanted to talk about like common apologist talking points and then just, undermine them. But then it turned into like a broader exploration of philosophy of religion. So I'm not really countering apologetics anymore. I'm mostly just discussing philosophy of religion, fairly open-mindedly. But yeah, at first it was just like I'm listening to apologists and they're making horrible arguments and like just really stupid points, and I'm not hearing anyone really identify in much detail why I think there are such bad points. So yeah, I mean, I just thought I had something unique to offer people, and I just had a lot to say about apologetics, and I was annoying the hell out of everyone in my life talking about it all the time, because they didn't have the same appetite for it that I did. So it was just the perfect outlet for talking endlessly about apologetics, which is all I wanted to do for a couple of years.
Yeah, so what are the ideas from the apologetics that irritates you the most?
Well, I mean, everyone picks on Frank Turek, and it is completely deserved. Like, I mean, like, if you just go through the list of things he says, I mean, that would cover like 75% of it. But it's honestly hard to think of specific examples because I don't engage with those people really anymore. Like, it's rare when I ever listen to them. Like, I'm so in my my little corner of the internet where I'm like pretty much exclusively interacting with Christians who I respect, but who, I mean, first of all, when I was a Christian, I would have regarded them as fake Christians. But like, I'm so, you know, I like only interact with the writings of people like, you know, Dustin Crummett or Kenny Pierce or Josh Rasmussen or Philip Swenson, or, you know, any number of others. It's like when I come in contact with apologists, it's like, oh my gosh, I forgot what you guys are mostly like. And that I'm dealing with a minority, but yeah, I mean, things that apologists say that annoy me. I mean, I guess that atheism leads to nihilism, you know, that's, not just like about the meaning of life, but like moral nihilism, like nothing is right or wrong. If God doesn't exist, that's retarded. Like obviously things are right and wrong. I mean, even if you're not a moral realist, you still like it's, there's no connection between atheism and moral anti-realism. Like there's just no, again, like God's existence or non-existence does not bear on the question at all, at all. Mm. So like, I just, it's, that's probably one of the more frustrating things to me. And I made a 2-hour video.
Yeah.
That was like a, you know, 2-hour love letter to the moral argument for God. So that's up there, but also, you know, implying that atheism leads to, or I mean, it entails materialism. Or, you know, just basically whenever anyone tries to connect atheism to like other seemingly random philosophical positions, that is guaranteed to bother me. And also just another categorical kind of thing for apologists. Mm. Like if they try to act like Christianity is a very narrow tradition and not like a diverse tradition, that also bothers me, you know, kind of on behalf of Christians, you know, and also on behalf of my former self, who is totally misled about, you know, the diverse nature of the tradition and everything, and what, you know, the diversity of what could count as real Christianity. Yeah, so I guess just treating the tradition as like much narrower than it actually is, and also just trying to force a bunch of views on atheists that we do not have to have, and that many of us don't have. Like the majority of atheist philosophers are moral realists, according to the 2020 PhilPaper survey. Yeah. You know, a lot of the leading non-physicalist philosophers are atheists, like David Chalmers or Thomas Nagel. You know, so that's the thing that bothers me the most, is like trying to force things on us that, you know, to like make our position less plausible, you know, in their minds.
Yeah, I ever heard your story about when you asked Frank Turek about a question about the inconsistency of the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and then he just brushed away your questions and then moved on. I think if I were in your position, that would be very, very, it would hurt me a lot, because it's that question is important towards my self identity, because if the God of the Bible is true, then that there cannot be an inconsistent type of God in whatever ways. I think that would be hurt. I think that would hurt me a lot. Can you tell me your emotion back then when answered like that by Frank Turek?
Yeah. So I met Frank Turek. I was at an apologetics conference, actually. It lasted for 2 weeks. And I actually met my wife there. It was in Colorado, in Manitou Springs. And it's called Summit. And by the way, I really loved that conference, you know, and it was really important to me for a number of reasons, not just because I met my wife there. But, you know, like intellectually, it was really important to me. And yeah, I mean, I'm glad that that exists, but anyway, it was like a 2-week long apologetics camp thing that I was voluntarily sent to by my increasingly concerned mother. Yeah, Frank Turek was there. He was one of the speakers, and we were out on this porch after one of his talks, and I just, you know, asked him a question about, you know, how do you explain the seeming personality differences between the Old Testament God and Jesus Christ? You know, they seem like they have different temperaments, you know, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So he goes, you know, there is none. There's no contradiction. Next question. And, you know, I was in a very like unstable point in my life, you know, like my faith was kind of collapsing around me. You know, my mom sent me there, or, you know, like I said, voluntarily, she asked me if I wanted to go, but, you know, like a concerned parent, you know, as I'm like badgering her more and more about like, you know, just random objections to Christianity and theism that are occurring to me and causing me to lose my faith, which, I was, you know, deadly serious about. Like I was very committed Christian and, yeah, I mean, like my life was like, it really revolved around my faith in many, many ways. And then it starts crumbling and I'm like losing my faith and it's very upsetting and destabilizing. Like I, you know, was psychologically destabilized. Like it was a really, really difficult time. And then, you know, I have, you know, one of many, you know, I mean, it's not like it was the number one concern for me, but I'm like, you know, the Bible does not seem like it's telling a totally coherent story. So, I mean, how do you iron out this this difficulty, you know, apologist who's here to answer my concerns? And he just goes, that's not a real problem. Shut up. Next question. And it's just like, you know, I mean, how stupid do you have to be as an apologist to, you know, like, I mean, there weren't any cameras on. Like, this is after the talk, you know, this is on the porch. Like, why are you trying to, like, dunk on me? So maybe if... maybe in his more considered, thoughtful, reflective moments, maybe he would see, oh, I shouldn't have done that, you know? But, I don't know. It seems like it's pretty consistent with the rest of his behavior, you know? And it's not like I think he's a really deep thinker on any topic anyway, but still, yeah, I was in a vulnerable, place, you know, and I was losing my faith and, you know, obviously just like, you know, swinging around how confident you are that that's not even a real problem does nothing for me, you know, does nothing for the people who are doubting, you know. And plus, like, again, this is like when apologists treat the tradition as narrower than it actually is, because you could reasonably come away from that thinking that's what I would have to believe if I were a Christian. I would have to believe, oh, geez, I can't tell the difference. Jesus and Yahweh seem like the same exact person. Like, if I were a Christian, I would have to believe that. But that's not true. If you don't have to believe that if you're a Christian, but like a reasonable person could come away, you know, I mean, I'm a teenager in this story. It's just like, I think you could come away being like, oh, I guess I would have to think that if I were a Christian, but, you know, I don't. So I guess I'm not going to be a Christian. You know, like, I mean, that's the calculation a lot of atheists make. Again, it's just a recipe for making deconverts. Like, here's this list of things that real Christians believe. And any, you know, people like David Bentley Hart, who, you know, totally accept that Jesus and Yahweh are not the same person. And he has some things to say about that subject that get him accused of being a Marcionite. You know, like, yeah. I'm just saying, it's a very, Christianity is a diverse tradition. How you view the Old Testament's pretty diverse. Or, you know, it can be. So anyway, all I'm saying is, Frank Turek just completely botched that. But the thing is, like, most apologists would have. And like, goddamn, what are you people doing? Like, what is so scary about just admitting that, like, yeah, you can have different views? You know, like, would it really kill you just to be like, you know, like would Christianity be like shaken to its core if you had a different view of like the Old Testament God? What does it even matter? Like, it's just so, it's so stupid. Like, I just don't get some of these apologists where it's like, they don't just want to defend Christianity. They want to defend like their hyper-specific, completely implausible and definitely false version of Christianity that like a smart teenager can pick apart, you know, totally pointless, bad strategy. But, yeah, I was not too fond of Frank Turek after that. And, the more I learned about philosophy of religion, the less fond I became of him.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, there is no such thing as Islamic apologist. If there is any, it's not a popular concept here in Indonesia. But
yeah, there are pretty few, like, you know, like on YouTube, it's kind of hard to find Muslim apologists. And yeah. I have to say that the couple of them that I've seen are they're like so unimpressive. They're really bad. It seems like they're like they're all Frank Turks, you know, like I don't know of any decent ones.
Those kind of Muslim apologetics make Frank Turk seems like a very smart person, I tell you. But you know, there are many scholars Muslim here in Indonesia. We call them ulama. Usually when tackled with such hard question, they too brush the issue as some kind of not very important. And when I first heard your story, I was quite surprised, because so that kind of actions not only happening in Indonesia, where we don't really question our faiths. So this was like a new information for me. I mean, I thought, this is my own opinion, I thought most of Christian apologetics is quite kind-hearted. That's for a start, and then much smarter and engaging than, you know, Muslims ulama. So to get back to my point, I think it hurts if you are being brushed aside when especially when the question is quite important towards your identity, right? So yeah, I just try to imagine that. Okay, so in one of your video, you quite critical about the skeptic community, and I think you're quite disillusioned by their attitude, mainly because they somehow display the same mannerism as Frank Turek, if I try to put it with my own word. My question is, why do you make a video about that, about the skeptics community?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I first deconverted, I, you know, joined up with the skeptic community. I was, you know, only interested in apologetics and stuff. And, you know, if you kind of run in those online circles, you're going to get sucked into the skeptic community. And like, they have organizations, you know, CFI, they have magazines like Skeptic Magazine, Skeptical Inquirer. So, I mean, there is like a real community, you know, there's, there's a magazine. It's not just channels and podcasts and stuff, even though that's like a huge, huge part of it. But yeah, there are events, you know, skeptical conventions and whatnot. So it's like, it's a real community that's active there. And, so, you know, that's kind of where I went, like right after I deconverted. And, you know, like I said, I'm only there for like religious reasons. Like, I just want to talk about apologetics. But suddenly, you know, I have an opinion about Bigfoot and the JFK assassination, because the skeptic community talks about those things too. Even though I never looked into those things, but, you know, suddenly I'm very, very, very confident that, like, you know, with the example of the JFK assassination, suddenly I'm very confident that the Warren Commission was completely correct. And it's like, I didn't really look into it, you know, but like, there were all these skeptics who were like supremely confident, you know, that that's how things are. And, you know, I just thought that like, they're the kind of people who would know. They were basically just trusted authority figures. I'm like, yeah, they're, you know, like Stephen Novella, who's like the host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, like a massive skeptical podcast. I'm just like, oh yeah, he's the kind of person who would know. He has all these, you know, blog posts about the JFK assassination. He's obviously researched it, and you know, that's what he's saying. So it wasn't like, something that I looked into personally though. And, I named a bunch of other subjects as well. Like, you know, James Randi had this $1 million prize. So anyone who could prove that they had some like parapsychological ability or something, they would get $1 million. So that's a very effective argument when you're a skeptic online and you say, oh, well, if that stuff is real, then why don't they just collect their $1 million? You know, so, but they haven't. So it's obviously not real. So they were just like, you know, like I said, I'm only here because of apologetics. And suddenly I have, you know, opinions about like a million different subjects that I've never looked into. So the problem for the skeptic community is that I started to look into a couple of these subjects and realized that I was completely misled about everything, like about everything that I bothered to look into. I'm just like, yeah, you guys are, this is not like a reasonable opinion. I mean, I guess that, and then when I confronted them with this, where I'd be like, you know, I was told this about, like, so I mean, I'm trying to be vague because there are like a dozen different topics that I have in mind, but even for things that you might think are definitely false, you know, you don't think that there's any plausibility to them, it's still important, I think, to like accurately represent the beliefs that you're targeting, right? Like, so even for a group as unsympathetic as like 9/11 truthers, who are just like widely maligned in the US, at least, like they're you know, like an extremely like hated and mocked group of people, but like, you know, everything I learned from the skeptic community about what they believe, it was like not true. Like, so they were just misrepresenting what they even thought, and I'm just like, what's the point of that? Like, why would you do that? Like, and plus, this is a very easily correctable, you know, like all you have to do is like read what they're saying and listen to the podcasts, you know, that are hosted by 9/11 truthers and stuff. And so I started doing that with different conspiracy theories and with different, you know, other common targets of skeptics, like cryptids or, you know, like paranormal stuff or whatever, which I'm not like endorsing all those things and saying I'm like a total believer in all these different conspiracy theories or cryptids or whatever. I'm just saying that skeptics misrepresented to me what they believed and also why they believe it. And those are, you know, kind of important details, especially if you're going to be like an effective skeptic. So the problem is, it's not just that like skeptics are kind of tribal and they never really read original like source material, and they endlessly pontificate, because lots of people are tribal. Like every group is going to do some version of the thing that I had a problem with, which is like, you know, you don't really go to primary sources very often. You just kind of read people who are already in your camp and kind of trust that they're representing to you what other people believe and why they believe it. Yeah, everybody does that. But skeptics present themselves as epistemic authorities. They're like, hey, I'm the rational grown up in the room, you know, like I'm actually, you know, speaking sense. Like I'm like, they're acting like they're the rational adults in the room. They're the epistemic authorities. You know, skeptic is like it's like an epistemic term, you know. And then when I started learning more, not just about philosophy of religion and epistemology, because they're so, so bad. They're Frank Turek level, like counter apologists. Okay. Like most of the people in the skeptic community that I've come across, they don't know anything about philosophy of religion, and they're really poor when it comes to epistemology. But it's just like, you can't present yourself as an epistemic authority and expect people not to hold you to a little bit of a higher standard. So like some of the problems with the skeptic community, people have rightly pointed out, they're like, yeah, these are problems with like any online community. And you know, that's true, but like they present themselves as epistemic authorities. That's why it bothers me so much. And yeah, so I just didn't like being misled by skeptics. Okay. Like I was misled by them over and over and over and over again. And then they are totally resistant to correction. If you say like, oh, you know, here's the reason why, for example, Oliver Stone thinks that the Warren Commission is false. I don't know how to explain it. It's like when you talk to them or when you argue with them, it just bounces off of their fucking skull. Like they just are totally unwilling to be corrected. Like they do not update their beliefs according to new information. They just like, I mean, I know I'm making generalizations here, but it's like, I'm frustrated because of the years I've spent interacting with them. And then as I started like distancing myself from them, I'm like, you know, this isn't correct, right? Like, you know, like you're misrepresenting like what these people believe and why they believe it. And actually in some cases, what they believe is kind of reasonable. And it's just like, it just doesn't matter. Like it just, again, it's just like in one ear and out the other, they don't hear you. And eventually I came to think like, okay, what is the thing that ties all these like skeptic beliefs together? Like the common list of things that skeptics believe. I know I've been pretty uncharitable in the last like 5 to 10 minutes here, but like, I honestly think that they're just going off of their vibes. Like they're just like, this is what like a reasonable You know, this is like the most sciencey feeling thing that I could say about this topic. You know, oh yeah, I'm a materialist. You know, I think consciousness is entirely physical. And it's like, do they have good arguments for that? No. Do they have any, do they have even the most basic understanding of arguments against physicalism? Nope, definitely not. But so it's like, so why are they so confident? It's like, well, I think because materialism and physicalism, like that's just kind of the thing that you'd think a rational, science-y kind of like, I fucking love science type individual would believe. And it's like, they're just going off of, yeah, anyway, sorry to repeat myself, but I think they're going off of vibes. I don't think there's any real connection between, you know, I mean, I'm just saying that's the only like glue that I can identify that puts all these things together, you know, like cryptid, like skepticism about cryptids and aliens and religion and parapsychology and, you know, the other list of things that they're skeptical of. You know, like I can't find a common method. I can't find like actual principles that they have. I can't find like a systematic understanding of the world. It just seems like all these things kind of have the same vibes to them.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I have two last question for you. The first one is, I think you already vaguely explaining the answer of this question, but I think it's useful if I ask you again. How do you define your moral philosophy?
Oh, well, moral philosophy, I think, is divided up into three big areas. So there's applied ethics, which is stuff that, you know, you can hear about, like that people like actively argue about on the news or something, like, you know, like should we legalize drugs or, you know, like should we outlaw abortion or something like that. So that's applied ethics. Normative ethics, you sort of get these theories of like, what do all the good things have in common, you know? So like that's where you get like utilitarianism. Yeah, it's a theory. Mm-hmm. It's like a normative theory, or like deontology or virtue ethics. And then meta ethics, which is the area I've thought the most about, is sort of the like the most abstract general kind of area of moral philosophy, where you just ask questions like, you know, how do we have moral knowledge, or like is right and wrong objective, or is it subjective, or, you know, are we just totally confused about good and evil, and like there's no objective fact of the matter. So, you know, I think that morality is objective. So I'm what's called an ethical non-naturalist. But yeah, I mean, I think that, which has nothing to do with like atheism, by the way, but I just think that, yeah, like there's objective right and wrong, you know, like I think suffering is bad, and that's a fact, you know. It's not a descriptive mm-hmm. fact. It's a, you know, normative fact or an evaluative fact. But yeah, I think there are objective evaluative facts, like suffering is bad. You shouldn't cause suffering for no reason, that sort of thing. So even if everyone came to believe that was not true, then they would just be wrong. You know, like just like, you know, 2 and 2 equal 4. And even if we all culturally agree that it is equal to greater than 4 or something, that doesn't matter. So like, you know, they would just, everyone would just be wrong. So that's what I think about morality. I think it's objective. And, you know, if everyone gets the wrong answer, then everyone is just objectively wrong.
Is there any question about morality that you wished you could answer in the future?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of them, I guess. I guess abortion comes to mind, because if what pro-life people are saying is correct, then, you know, there's some really horrible things going on. And if they're not correct, then it would be nice if they, you know, stopped doing what they were doing. So I guess abortion is the answer for me, because it seems like it's the most consequential. Like if abortion is, you know, permissible in every case, that would be pretty huge. So I guess, you know, or I mean, just finding out either way, I would want to know, because I think it would have like dramatic consequences either way. Like, we either need to really stop what we're doing and just completely outlaw it, or if it's permissible, then pro-life people need to stop haranguing women outside of clinics and stuff and stop trying to outlaw it. Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those, it's just one of those things I wish I could just get the right answer to really quickly, because I mean, it's like, it's just an extremely consequential issue, you know, either way. But especially if pro-life people are right. So I would like to have the answer to that, I guess. And I guess I think abortion is permissible in many, if not most, cases. But I hold on to that belief loosely. You know, I'm not like positive about that.
Emerson Green, thank you very much.